You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming up after 4, Governor Walker wants Wisconsin to be the first state to eliminate laws that require schools to provide a minimum amount of instruction hours for students. We look at what it means for students and the education system.
First, go into any grocery store in the U.S. any time of the year, and you can be pretty sure that you can find a banana, and that it will look and taste like the last banana you bought, and like the next one, too.
Unless you are buying directly from local producers, that's true of a lot of the fruits and vegetables that we eat and depend on. And while consistency and year-round availability might seem like signs of scientific advancement, they can also indicate a loss of genetic diversity and risks to our global food supply.
Rob Dunn has traced crashes in food crops as well as the efforts of scientists to prevent further catastrophes. He's a professor of applied ecology at North Carolina State University. His most recent book is titled Never Out of Season: How Having the Food We Want When We Want It Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much, Judith. Great to be on the show. That was a great intro.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And I'm sure it's going to be a great conversation because this is really a fascinating book. How did you decide to explore threats to agricultural diversity?
Well, so I started my career focused on forest recovery in the Amazon. And so I worked on these old fields that were abandoned because of various disasters. I was looking at old cacao fields that had collapsed, old cassava fields that had collapsed. And so I'd been thinking for much of my career about the interactions that set the stage for those sorts of collapses. And it just finally started to come together that these were the same kinds of stories that I'd been dealing with when we study what lives on human bodies or what lives in houses, that they're all stories about the complex ecology that links us to other species. And so I just became fascinated with it and couldn't turn away. So then it became a book.
There are so many stories that illustrate your concerns, but let's take an example that actually might explain a lot of our listeners actually being in this state, being in this country. That's the potato and the tragedy that affected the Irish. What happened there?
Well, I mean, it's a fascinating story. So the potato is Andean, and in the Andes, there were more than 1,000 varieties of potatoes and other root and tuber crops. And the conquistadors brought some back, and they got to the Canary Islands. And then of those that the conquistadors took, a couple of varieties became popular in Northern Europe and in Ireland. And they were amazing. People could feed a whole family just on potatoes and milk. And in Ireland, that became the mainstay for the vast majority of people, which was a heroic sort of moment in modern agriculture, the ability to eat just one thing and still be really healthy. But it set the stage for a collapse unlike anything anybody had ever seen before. And what happened was that a pathogen, something called the oomycete, which is we used to think of as a fungus, but really it's its own branch of life, showed up in continental Europe, and people started to bicker about what caused it. And everybody hoped it would never get to Ireland because the Irish were so dependent on the potato. But this was a time when nobody understood germ theory very well. And so nobody really knew what a pathogen was in general, much less what this thing was that was making the potatoes sick. And so while the scientists bickered, this thing called the late blight got to Ireland, and over a series of years would proceed to wipe out potato fields, and with it, people's livelihoods. And so in the end, over 1 million Irish died, and nearly as many Irish emigrated. And it changed the makeup of the United States and started, really, our modern obsession with monoculture. We learned almost the exactly wrong lesson from the story.
Well, and what I found really interesting is things that were collected in the Andes, there are hundreds of varieties of what we would refer to as a potato, but you know, they're very distinct. They have very distinct qualities, growing conditions, but it was one particular kind of potato that became so popular in Ireland, and so basically every potato was susceptible to the same things.
Yeah, that's right. This is the way we farm almost everything now. You know, we find the variety that makes a lot of whatever we want, and we plant that everywhere. And that has lots of benefits. And in Ireland, before the famine, it had tons of benefits. More people could exist on the same amount of land than could otherwise. But it also has this cost. And the other thing to me that's fascinating about the potato example is, I think we imagine that some wise person out there is choosing the perfect varieties of each of these things for us on our behalf. But there's a lot of idiosyncrasy, too. And so the kind of potato that became popular in Ireland, you know, the initial filtering that got it to Europe, it was just a bunch of hungry, stinky conquistadors who were sort of grabbing what they could find. And so there was never a moment, there never has been a moment when somebody's gone, oh, what would be the best varieties for us to have? Which things do we want? Which ones are resistant? And so we're still really beholden to these weird idiosyncratic histories of hundreds of years ago.
So how did we get to the point where, as we said in the introduction, you can go into any grocery store, any day of the year, any season, and get what is immediately identifiable as a banana? And why are they so consistent from day to day, from year to year, from store to store?
Well, the banana story is really, I mean, it's almost identical in many features to the potato story, that, you know, once, except that it has this transport component, you know, so the potatoes were being eaten locally, the bananas get transported, but for most of the history of the banana, people ate a bunch of local varieties of bananas. Bananas were domesticated in Papua New Guinea, moved through tropical Asia. But then it became clear that there was potentially a market in temperate places like the U.S. and Europe if you could get bananas to the table, but you had to ship them somehow. And so the nascent banana industry was on the lookout for something you could plant a lot of. You could put it on a boat. You could get it to New Jersey and New York and the U.S. And so they found this variety of banana that was sort of perfectly shippable. It was not remotely the most tasty or the most nutritious or anything, but it would grow well and you could ship it. And that was called the Gros Michel. And so in the 1940s and early 50s, that banana was planted throughout Central America at a scale so grand that it was almost like a country of bananas. And they were all planted clonally, so no seeds. And so they were all identical. And so, like, if you went and sampled a Gros Michel in Ecuador and you sampled one in Panama, they were more similar to each other than a cell in your toe would be to a cell in your eye. And so for shipping and for eating and for always having the same banana, it was perfect. It was just what consumers wanted. It was just what industry wanted. But, of course, it was just like the potato famine, too. And so if any pathogen could ever find the Gros Michel, it was in trouble, and that's just what happened. And so once again, we planted a monoculture. The pathogen caught up, and the pathogen wiped out the Gros Michel.
And now we have, I believe it's the Cavendish banana?
Yeah, and so the industry panicked, industry searched the world, and industry got lucky and found something that looked more or less like the Gros Michel but tastes quite a bit different, and did exactly the same thing with that. And so now the Cavendish is planted in many of those same countries the Gros Michel was planted in, and it too is susceptible to a bunch of different pathogens, and so there are now several that threaten to wipe it out. And so we do this again and again, but you know, we love to have these foods that look the same, and we love for them to be really cheap. And so that combined with the tendencies of industry favor these big monocultures.
So what, Rob, is lost when plants are grown in other places than where they originated? And so they're without their usual complementary species present?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, one of the things that happens is we get escape. And so you take a banana that has pests and pathogens in Papua New Guinea and you move it to the Americas, and it escapes those pathogens, and so it grows much better. But the other piece, and so that's also part of what makes it so devastating when they catch up. But the other piece is that our crops also escape their beneficial species. And so cassava is really interesting in this regard. Manioc, it's the plant that makes tapioca. But is also the main sustenance for hundreds of millions of people in the tropics. So it's native to the Americas, very near to the place in Bolivia where I used to work, but moved to Africa, moved to tropical Asia, And when it did, it escaped almost all of its pests and pathogens. But then one of those caught up, the cassava mealybug, and threatened basically to wipe out cassava. And the eventual solution to this, which is a pretty amazing story in and of itself, was to find a parasitoid, a wasp, that lays its eggs inside the body of that mealybug and then eats it from the inside out, which then has saved cassava. That wasp has spread across Africa. But because we didn't study cassava in its native range, we didn't know about that wasp, and we left it behind. And so we do that with lots of things. You know, chocolate, we actually don't know what pollinates chocolate in the Amazon, which is a crazy sort of thing. How could we not know? And yet much of these things we could study about our crops, nobody's ever studied, because we're really focused on today, tomorrow, you know, how are we going to get more bananas, more wheat for the next week?
We're talking with Rob Dunn about his most recent book titled Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want When We Want It Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future. Rob is a professor of applied ecology at North Carolina State University.
And we want to know what you're thinking at 800-642-1234. Is the information that Rob is sharing with us new to you? Does the seeming lack of seed diversity worry you? Share your comments at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with scientist Rob Dunn about his book, Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want When We Want It Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you give much thought to how we are able to have many fruits and vegetables available year-round? Does it concern you that we have such a small amount of diversity in what we eat? And what questions do you have for Rob about ways that scientists and the public can try to counteract the current situation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So, Rob, we could go on and on talking about different examples of this with rubber, with cacao, as you mentioned. But I want to focus in on the people who have been working against time to prevent future crises from occurring. And one story that was just really gripping is that of Nikolai Vavilov. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Vavilov is an amazing guy. He was a Russian scientist who became fascinated with the diversity of crops around the world. And he came into science at a time when sort of Mendelian genetics and Darwinian evolution were starting to be integrated. And there was this sense of a powerful new approach to thinking about how we breed crops and what might be next. But Vavilov recognized that whatever we were going to do in the future, we needed to have as many varieties of crops from around the world as sort of the raw material with which to work to do that. And so he set about traveling the world to understand where's the greatest diversity of crops, how could he collect them, what was the traditional knowledge around those crops, and then he set about planting them in different parts of Russia to understand which of those varieties of crops were best for drought, which were best for pathogens, in order to set the stage for a grand project that he really imagined would not last his lifetime, but instead, you know, hundreds of years or maybe longer. And so it's to him that we owe a huge debt in terms of understanding, you know, where are the hot spots of varieties of wheat, of chili peppers, of chocolate, of all of these other things that we need to make sure we save. And so if that was his whole story in and of itself, it would be, I think, pretty heroic. But apropos of our elements of our own time, He fell afoul of a Soviet government that was not supportive of science and supported a sort of counterfactual approach to science based on a guy named Lyshenko. And so Vavilov initially became marginalized, and then during the war he became imprisoned. In theory, he was imprisoned for his, you know, radical views and propaganda against the country. In practice, it was really for doing science. And so the war starts, and his sort of tragic story then unfolds from that moment. And what happens to him, I think, is both humbling relative to our current global moment and where science sits in society, and maybe emboldens one to make sure to do the work that needs to be done.
Well, and talk about heroes. So there was Vavilov himself, but then there was his whole crew of scientists who, when World War II was really threatening the places where these seeds were saved and these seed potatoes were saved, they gathered them all in Leningrad, and literally some of them die at their desks surrounded by bags of rice that they could have been eating, but they were so committed to the preservation of these seeds for future generations that they couldn't even bring themselves to eat it when literally their lives were on the line.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I mean, I think about that all the time. It was actually quite hard to write about. I mean, just this or last week, there's a collection in Louisiana that was threatened, not of seeds, but of plants and insects and all sorts of other things. And we're always, as scientists, sort of fighting to keep these kinds of collections going. And you know, they're not so expensive in the big scheme of things, but they need to be tended to. And then we look back at, you know, Vavilov's workers, and there they are in the collection dying for the same sort of cause that, you know, I think at the end of the day, oh, do I have time to do something else on behalf of that collection? But boy, it's really something, and it gives me a lot of pause and gives me the shivers thinking about it. But to those people, we owe many of the varieties that would resuscitate Russian agriculture after the war. And there's not a very good tally, but most people suspect some of the varieties that are being used in agriculture around the world. And so you may eat the consequences of that heroic story.
We're talking with Rob Dunn about his latest book, Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want When We Want It Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future. You can join in by calling 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones now. And Don in DeForest is up. Hi, Don.
Hi. I was particularly struck by how much our food has changed and their efforts to keep food, oranges orange and bananas yellow and viable in cross-country shipments or around-the-world shipments. We now have the oranges, but I no longer eat them because they are flavorless. They're juicy, and that's about it. That strawberries fell to this horrible thing 10, 15 years ago, and just in the last few years I've noticed that blueberries now are becoming the next juicy, flavorless item on the tack.
Thanks for that call, Don. And Rob, certainly that's something that I've noticed as well. Have we basically sacrificed the enjoyment of eating for consistent supply?
Yeah, I mean, I think globally that's a big part of this story. I think locally there are lots of exciting, you know, things going on where people are, if they have the means, investing a little more money in heritage varieties of crops and things at farmers markets with special flavors and, locally grown things that grow where people are. But for sure, the main global story is that we're eating fewer and fewer kinds, species of crops, and of those crops, the varieties we're eating, they grow a lot, they ship well, they don't have very much flavor, and when you grind them up, they make good processed food.
So, Rob, are there still areas in the world where there is still considerable diversity?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it can change very fast within a region, and so, I mean, to take a couple of good news stories, in Merida, in Mexico, Mexico has an amazing agricultural heritage, and in Merida there are there are now farmers markets that specialize in local heritage varieties of crops. And there's really now a food scene there that emphasizes traditional varieties, traditional flavors, traditional knowledge thereof. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing, if you know, when we have the chance to support markets like that, it's great. Similar example in the Andes, there's now a national park that focuses on conserving, you know, not necessarily wild places, but instead farmers farming traditional varieties of potatoes. And, you know, that's a resource for people in the Andes, but it's also a resource for all of us when we need those. And so the same is true. Ethiopia still has a lot of amazing heritage crops that we don't see very often. And then there are places that, you know, if you look 20 years ago, there wouldn't have been much, but now there's been a renewed sort of resuscitation of those crops. And so in Scandinavia, the focus on new Nordic cuisine and figuring out, well, what are the Scandinavian crops? What are our heritage varieties? Has really triggered a reinvestment in the farming of those varieties. And you see them in stores now in a way that you didn't used to. And so I think those kinds of examples are hopeful. For sure, the dominant, you know, grocery store counterexample is less hopeful. But I think we can make big changes. And I think the important thing to remember is you can make a local change that has a really big impact on the overall story. And so what you purchase, what you grow, is really important in this. The other part, too, that's interesting to me is that very often we know very little about these crops, even though we imagine otherwise. And so in my lab, we're trying to figure out ways for the public to help us in studying some of these crops. And so we have a project called the Great Pumpkin Project.
And unfortunately, Rob, we are out of time, but we'll make sure to post a link about the Pumpkin Project on Facebook. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Judith. Wonderful program. Have a great day.
You too. Rob Dunn is the author of Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want, When We Want It, Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future.